Right, Freddie, you're next.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Listen, I mean, probably not come as a surprise to many of you that are here this evening that Paul and I are brothers, and therefore we're born of, well, I say therefore, we're born of the same parents. So therefore, you know, like Paul, my mum was German, my dad Welsh, etc. But I can't remember in my upbringing, not readily remember anyway, of having any particular strong feelings about being Scottish, or Welsh or German. Now, whether or not that was because my mum and dad didn't particularly go on about that sort of thing, but I certainly recall as a child. And it was grievous at times, so hard at times to hear the way that my mother got spoken to by people as soon as they could hear the German accent. It was really quite awful to hear of it. And invariably at times, some of the altercations I got involved in as a youngster, was because of and my older brother Ronnie, he was actually born in Germany. The altercations that got involved in was because of the way that the mother got treated, whereas my father never got treated that way, you know, because he was Welsh, etc. And so therefore, I also recognise that immediately after the war, or not so long after the war, the end of the war. There was perhaps a lot of more anti-German feeling, etc. But I can't readily recall any sort of time in which I would say that I love Scotland. I can't recall at any time ever having any sort of nationalistic feelings about being Scottish or being born in Scotland. And when I say I love it, it's generally because of the people that I met in Scotland, and I still go back to Scotland regularly. But that's for the people that I grew up with there in many ways. And I think, you know, the sort of general country itself, in terms of its scenery and such like, is a lovely, lovely place to go. So I don't readily recall ever having any strong sort of feelings about, oh, I'm Scottish and I'm proud to be living here, etc. But this question about Scottish nationalism, I think it is still pretty strong there. And, you know, I mean, I can't recall how many years ago either, but, you know, they no longer sort of sing God Save the King or Queen, do they? I mean, it's now all about Flower of Scotland or when will we see your lights again, and so on. So there is still that aspect of nationalism there. And, you know, this sort of thing about being Scottish or English or Welsh, whatever, I can't recall it ever appealing to us, which was one of the reasons I think that when I came across the party in the first instance, that and their views about it did strike a chord with me. So you know, well, and whilst there has been some aspects of capitalism that you support, and Paul mentioned one or two of them there. Yes, you could turn around and say, "Oh, yeah, that, you know, that's sort of beneficial to the working class," but is that what we really want? Is that what we really want as socialists? You know, we don't want to be getting kicked to high heaven. Or sorry if anyone thinks that's a religious thing when I say that there. So there are aspects of capitalism that you could look at and think, yeah, well, that's of some sort of benefit overall to the working class. But is the rationale behind it really? Is that are some of these benefits actually for the working class? Or is it because it suits capitalism's interest? And I think invariably it's because it suits capitalism's interest that, like, there's a story behind the story. And in terms of just laterally there, this part about the name of the party, this SPGB, I don't see why it would change it at all, really. SPGB, part of the World Socialist Movement, and that's what we're advocating, World Socialism. We're not just advocating, well, we know we can't have socialism in Britain. So, yeah, it's this whole question about nationalism is something that could go on for some length of time, this sort of discussion. But I agree with what Paddy was saying some maybe half an hour ago, that there is, I know when my nephew is a teacher in Leeds, and when I get talking to him about the sort of education system and what they're getting taught in school now, there is quite a bit of variation from what I recall when I was getting sort of taught in school as a child, that there doesn't seem to be that much about nationalism, as we would recall, or as I recall it anyway, that much about nationalism, about God save the king or queen, or whatever it might be. It doesn't seem to be that extent now, and that perhaps might be because of a more sort of European outlook than what there was 50, 60 years ago. So, but I certainly wouldn't change the party's name. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. We've got two more people, Richard and then Steve. So Richard first.
Let Steve go first, because I've already spoken, so I'll come back afterwards.
Okay, Steve, want to speak? You're still muted. We can't hear you.
Right, there you go. Right.
Yeah, we can now, yeah.
Yeah. Hi, comrades. Thanks for letting us onto this site. Nationalism seems to, from where I come from, is the last few years has increased. I don't know whether it's because of this reaction to the boats or the immigrants, but people I've known for years are becoming more nationalistic. And what we can do, I don't think, is to pander to that by changing our name. Our first joined the Socialist Party in 1981, and ever since then, there was a discussion whether we should change the name of the Socialist Party. And would that, have an accusation against the Socialist Party that was being pushed into it by other people. No matter what we call ourselves, we're going to always meet up with this discussion. What shall we call ourselves? The Socialist Party? Socialist Party of Great Britain? SPGB? World Socialist Party of the UK? Or Great Britain, and this is a minutia. We should be concentrating totally on advocating for a different society, society based on production and distribution and consumption as voluntary human beings, where we're not in a relationship of master and slave in any way, shape or form. And the nationalist argument detracts from the socialist argument that we've given since 1904.
Okay, thanks. I should explain. I only introduced the GB part in the connection with us using that name in Wales and Scotland. Anyway, that's a diversion. So, Richard, you're on now, and then Joel.
Yeah, I was just thinking about what people were saying, and I don't know if Dave actually brought this up when in his talk, but I don't think anybody has actually said much so far about the relationship of capitalism itself to nationalism, because nationalism does seem very much to have been an ideology associated with the development of capitalism. You know, and you can trace it historically, this wave of nationalism sort of spreading in the 19th century across Europe, from Western Europe, and eventually into the Balkans, where it becomes suddenly you had the Ottoman Empire, you had all these great baggy international empires like the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, and there was no, these were sort of very personalized empires because you actually had a family at the head of them. And so the idea of nationality wasn't really at all sort of that fundamental to what they were. They were often overlapping, you know, sort of. So, for example, the Austro-Hungarian empire would overlap with, you know, with other sort of dynastic states, so that they would actually, one of them would have certain responsibilities over a certain area and another one would have other responsibilities. And people who live within them often actually didn't have a sense of, you know, sort of belonging to any kind of national entity. I mean, there is a story that immigrants to America at the first part of the 20th century, that the clerks there on Ellis Island, who were responsible for admitting immigrants into the United States, often had a real headache when they asked people where they were from, what country they were from, and they often didn't know. They had no conception of actually coming from a particular country. They belonged to one of these big baggy empires that existed in Europe at that time. And with the collapse of those empires and the emergence after the First World War of nation states, this seems to be very much, you know, sort of the idea of a highly concentrated, centralized capitalist entity. You know, sort of nationalism seems to be an expression of that. So that's kind of mainly what I was saying. It was just actually occurred to me. I'm just thinking about sort of Bulgaria and Greece, suddenly with the rise of nationalism in the 19th century, breaking away from the Ottoman Empire, suddenly, whereas up until that time, Greek and you know, sort of Bulgarians, Greek speakers and Bulgarian speakers, although they kind of clashed with the sort of central authorities from time to time, were largely kind of quite content to remain part of the empire. And Jews, of course, were very happy to escape from Western Europe into the Ottoman Empire, where they actually had a much better status than they actually had in the West. So I don't really know much about this. I haven't really studied this relationship between capitalism and nationalism, but they do seem very, very much to go together. So that's what I wanted to say.
Okay, thanks. Joel.
Hello. I hope this doesn't go away from the point. It's just something I read a few days ago. It was regarding the pupil who took a case out against what is deemed the strictest school in the UK, which she lost. But one of the rules are that the school has, that the pupils have to sing the national anthem twice a day. I just thought I'd mention that. It did make me smile, the sort of old thing about freedom to sort of pray and practice your religion, and then they have this rule about singing the national anthem twice a day. Thank you.
Yes. Right, Dougie.
I talk to people quite a lot, just at bus stops and, you know, when I go out and things. And a lot of them have this problem with people coming across in small boats, you know. And they say they're young men and, you know, they're not coming from unsafe countries and stuff. Well, they don't really know. But anyway, I looked into this, and they reckon this year there'll be about 740,000 people coming in legally. And they reckon the small boats will be about 50,000, which is a record for the numbers from them. But, you know, I think, you know, the right-wing press play on this, really. You know, GB News and the Daily Mail and the Daily Express, and they play on nationalism. And I've heard people say, you know, you've got to look after British people first and all the rest of it. And you do have that nationalistic idea, right, you know. And I think it's a shame, right, you know. I mean, if you met some of these people, they are coming from poverty or whatever, or they're really struggling. They're coming from war-torn countries, you know, which is partly due to Britain and America and places like that invading and Russia as well. Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I just think. I mean, I had a woman told me people are coming here for benefits or whatever, you know. I said to her, look, most of these people want to work, really, you know, and they can pay for your pension or whatever. And I also said, you know, the CEO of British Gas has got 100% pay rise from 4 million to 8 million. And she's talking about people coming for the paltry amount of money they give them while they put them up on barges or hotels or whatever. I mean, and they don't let them work. And I mean, the whole thing's terrible, really. But that's the attitude people have.
It's not all that bad, because as somebody pointed out, that the when the new, what is called, First Minister or Prime Minister of Wales, his mother is African, I think. So you've now got the four prime ministers of the British Isles. They're all descended from people who are fairly recent immigrants. You got the Prime Minister himself. You got the bloke in Scotland. Well, I don't know about the woman in Northern Ireland, but I suppose she regards herself as Irish and not as British. So I think racism isn't as strong as some people, you know, make out. There are nasty racists around, but I think they must be a majority, because, you know, nobody seems to. It doesn't seem to have done any of these parties any harm to have somebody who isn't 100%, you know, British or Welsh or Scottish. But tomorrow, incidentally, is St George's Day, which always annoys me, because I boycott the pubs because they're all flying the National Front flag, and I don't know, perhaps I shouldn't be, but I mean, I've never felt English. At all, you know, I never felt Welsh or Irish either, but I never spelt English in particular. But anyway, watch out tomorrow. It's National Front Flag Day. Okay, Steve, you want to come back again?
Yes, please. What I was thinking of, when we're talking about the boats going over and people associating themselves with invaders or whatever they want to call them, do they ever think of people like the owners of the Premier League football clubs? You know, these people just go anywhere in the world they want, whenever they want. There's no problem. And yet, if somebody comes in and he doesn't have guilt, he doesn't have the wherewithal, you know, they're deemed as aliens. And people in this country don't actually, or can't, put themselves in the same situation as these immigrants coming over. They should ask themselves, what would I do in the same situation? Would I stay in Libya? Would I stay in Syria? Would I stay in Iraq? Would I stay in Iran? Or would I try to get myself and my family to a safe place? When you think about it like that, national borders are irrelevant. When you think like that, you're thinking as a human being. If we can put ourselves, or get other people to put themselves in the position of the ordinary people that are trying to get into this country, because We don't have any more right to this country than anybody else because we haven't got the force behind us. So what we should be doing is trying to get people to put themselves in a similar situation as the people that's trying to get in here. And if we did that, then we have more of a, you know, a human understanding of what people are going through and what we go through if we're in that situation.
Right, thanks. I think, in fact, that's what we do try to do. If we don't, it's what we should try to do. Okay, thanks, Steve. Andy?
Well, just checking, does John want to speak before me? I've had a couple of goes already, so I'm more than happy to let John go. His hand has just gone up.
Second-guessing the chairman again. Okay, John, you go first.
You're muted, John. We can't hear you.
Okay, chairman. John, you speak first. If you unmute it.
Sorry about that little delay. thanks, Andy. I just wanted to say that basically concerning all the nasty propaganda about the boat people and all that, the Tory party is so desperate to cling to power that it's trying all the old tried and tested nasty vicious prejudices that it can dredge up. And I've thought for some time that they're underestimating the population generally, but it's also said that appealing to the lowest common denominator never does you any harm in politics. And by that, I suppose they mean in capitalist politics with parties like the Tories and the Labourites. And you know, you have people in the Tory party that, you know, that just seems to be all they talk about is the boat people. And, well, that's going to be counterproductive because they've been a dismal failure in even stopping these people that they say are causing such problems. But they never mention anything about governments not allowing for the fact that people are coming here to work and, you know, that governments haven't provided, you know, changes to infrastructure, changes that would allow the population a certain amount of sort of comfort, you might say, only to the extent conducive to, you know, your continued wage slavery. But nonetheless, you know, the government has a responsibility in all these things, but no, they would rather just blame poor people that have struggled to get here. And let's face it, they must be pretty desperate to try and get into this shithole of a place. I mean, I know compared to other parts of the world, it's not that bad, but that doesn't make it really that great either. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Okay, now, Andy, you're on again.
Thank you. I've just actually made a quick bullet point sort of note just to keep me on track. I know we're coming up towards 9 o'clock, but I think following on from John's point, successive capitalist governments have actually determined the capitalist economic model to rely on cheap foreign labour. You know, that's a fact of life, isn't it? They've really built this idea of a low wage, kind of multi employment, low wage economy in the UK and offshored all the sort of profits, basically. So things here that are needed to be done are mainly service industry things or small technical manufacturing things or things like health work, care work, just kind of patching the workers up and looking after those that are unable to work. So essentially Britain has needed young, fit workers. Now, I know that for a fact in my own industry that I work in. I manage health and social care services. I am employed to run residential care homes for adults with learning disabilities. And all the people, bar a small percentage, are immigrant workers. They're mainly, in my case, from India. Actually really good. They're very, very good. They've got great work ethic. They learn quickly. They're pretty well educated once they pick up the language. And they're nice people. They're really good to work with, and they're very, very easy to manage. Let's just put it that way. So that's one side of this. And then also on the sort of issue, and I'm talking specifically about where I live, so I'm just talking about myself in terms of like my take on how society is. I live in the English Midlands, as you can probably detect from my accent. I live in a part of a town called Walsall, but I live in a little village just outside of Walsall, albeit it's in the Walsall Council area, which is very white. It's called Aldridge. It's a small, nice place. People have nice gardens, nice presented houses. I've got one of the smallest houses in Aldridge. There are some really big ones here, but mine isn't like that. And so where I go to work is up the road. It's about 10 miles away in the town of Wolverhampton. So I drive to Wolverhampton every day up a road, the Black Country route. And on that route, generally speaking, people in cars going to and from work, right, are probably, and this is no exaggeration, I actually thought about this while I've been in traffic jams going to and fro, you probably get 50% people with white skin and 50% people with darker skin, right? That's the way it is in this part of the world. To be really honest, there's no issues with racism, etc. It's a really quite... it's okay, generally okay. I've dropped my book, but anyway, it's not a big deal. People get on really well. And the other little small point I wanted to make, again, being sort of a bit personal about this, is I mentioned earlier on that my mum is from Ireland. She's very, very Irish. You know, her name is Mary Murphy. She was born on a farm in Galway. And just like Richard Field, all my relatives, as I was a small boy, all had Irish accents. Everybody was Irish, apart from my Welsh granddad, who was stationed in Northern Ireland during the Second World War and met my granny on my paternal side in Newry town. Hence my dad was born, but then my dad was brought to Wales to be born. And so I always said to my dad, Dad, what am I? I'm born in England. All my relatives are Irish, apart from granddad, who's Welsh. What am I? You know, and dad always said to me, he said, be yourself, just be yourself. Wherever you go, just be yourself. And I think that that's the way to be. So I hope I haven't whittled on too much, but anyway, thanks very much.
Okay, thanks. Anybody else want to say anything? We don't have to finish at 9. It's not compulsory. There was something that Paul said I didn't agree with about this new law that's been introduced in Scotland, which means you can't express in private objectionable views. I mean, when... Stephen Lawrence was murdered in London all those years ago. They had the McPherson inquiry, and this judge, he put forward this: it should be a crime to express racist views like I've gone it in your home. But the government in England, or government in Britain, turned that down because it's impossible to enforce. So I would disagree with Paul. I think that in fact, what they're trying to do in Scotland is, in fact, is a restriction on free speech You know, I mean, you can't control or punish people for views that they might just express in their own home, which I think could happen if somebody, you know, if somebody reports you. Okay, Paul, you want to come back?
Now, if I didn't know you better, Adam, I think you were provoking a bit of a response there. But hey, Paul, I wouldn't blame you for that. It's not, that's not the intention behind the legislation, at least that's not my understanding of it. Everyone's entitled to free speech and say what they think within reason. The same rules that apply is when you, some of the, one particular example is when you're studying law, is free speech is free speech to a reasonable or an acceptable level as to what the average man or woman in the street might understand. In other words, you cannot walk into a cinema full of people enjoying a film and start shouting, there's a fucking bomb, there's a bomb, when there isn't one, and cause chaos and mayhem, and everyone goes rushing out of the cinema and there's a stampede, and put it down to, oh, I was just having a laugh, it was a joke. There's a limit to how much free speech can go. Now, of course, if in the privacy of your own home, a bunch of Orangemen or Irishmen or homophobes want to sit and discuss amongst themselves their dislike of a certain identity of person, whatever that may be, then that's their call. But it's when it goes public and it gets or a particular minority group is targeted, or a particular minority person is targeted, then it spills over. It's trying to find of course, it's every legislation, every law. It has to take time to bed in. There has to be test cases, but there's what is obviously what's acceptable to one person is not necessarily acceptable to another. But there's a difference between free speech and hate speech, and I think that that's what the legislation is trying to target. You know, it would be impossible to police every single, you know, expression of opinion. But it's when it crosses a line and it becomes harmful, and it becomes harmful not to someone that's maybe regarded as being oversensitive. Of course, you know, that would maybe be for a judge to decide if it eventually gets that far. But I think, in generally speaking, the intention behind the legislation is good, and I think although it'll take time to settle down, it's not perfect, but in my humble opinion, it's fundamentally good, and that's my understanding of it. Cheers.
Okay, thanks. Okay, John, you want to say something?
Yes, I think legislation of this sort is, although you could argue it's well-intentioned, and I don't know what the intentions are behind some of these people in the SNP, it's very difficult because they become quite divorced from real people's concerns. But the unfortunate thing about this sort of legislation is that it makes what the media people call ordinary people, in other words, people like us, members of the working class, a bit reticent about saying anything at all. It makes people, in fact, almost frightened to speak, because the clever people in the media, the chiacchierati that are so full of knowledge, as they think. These are the people that are experts, so-called, in these fields, and their opinions are to be listened to. But the likes of us, no, because we might be a bit more roughly spoken, perhaps we're just full of prejudice and we're as well to shut up. So that's my take on this sort of legislation. I don't think it's a good thing at all. I think we're in danger of governments are in danger of over legislating for these things, because after all, they already have laws against incitement to racial hatred, for example, or if you're some kind of right wing or mad left wing agitator, there's certain things you can't say. It's not meant to be legal to incite members of Her Majesty's forces to disaffect, but of course many people have done that and will continue to do that, and it's a good thing that that law isn't seriously enforced. So I think what we have to do is kind of rely on people becoming more educated about the society in which they're in, and not to have these prejudiced views, but to rely on the state regulating workers' ability to express themselves is not a good thing at all. Thanks.
Thanks. Do you want to come back, Paul?
Yeah, I'd say that uneducated is probably the best use of terminology there to describe maybe what John's view of the subject is. Perhaps if he'd read the legislation and take an alternative view of it, and of course we all respect his views and he's entitled to them and his opinions. That's what being democratic is all about. This particular legislation was designed to include other more marginalised groups, like, for example, one that I'm particularly passionate and interested in, and that is the subject of those with disabilities, who are very often forgotten about as a targeted hate group. Now, as I emphasised before, of course, we'd all rather everyone was less prejudiced and more amenable and cooperative and friendly with each other. Sadly, that's not the case. So therefore, if the only means of protection is the law to at least attempt to prevent or put people off, may or may not work, from committing crimes as they will or as they will now become, then sadly that's the only ammunition we've got for people in marginalised groups. Whether it's to do with your sexuality, your gender, the colour of your skin, your disability, or anything like that. Nobody's saying that people shouldn't be open to criticism and should not have their own views and opinions. It's when it goes beyond that, it becomes a different matter. In order to try and prevent that from happening and stop people from being targeted in a hateful manner, then again, I think it's a good thing, and I respect John's opinion that he feels it's not. It's a good thing, but for those of us living in marginalised groups who have been victims of hate crime, then I can assure you it is probably going to be a good thing. Cheers.
Okay, let's hope the courts interpret the law sensibly. Right, Steve, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I'm disabled. I've got multiple sclerosis, I'm in a wheelchair. And I've noticed today that Fishy Rishi is himself somebody who talks about getting rid of all this hate and stuff in society. He's actually today brought out a thing about this sick note culture, which is going to lead to people like myself going to be put in a situation whereby we might be targeted by the ignorant people within the societies we live in or the communities. And it's the same all of the time, gaslighting people. And why isn't Rishi Sunak, why isn't he being brought up for hate speech? Because that's what he's doing. He's leading community as a whole to target a specific set of that community. And it's just the same as the foreign secretaries we've had and the home secretaries we've had who've targeted. And in the main, the home secretaries are actually first or second generation immigrants themselves, and they've added to the hate speech. Why aren't they taken to court? Because they don't say this just in the Houses of Parliament, where they have, you know, a license to do or say whatever they want, but to say it in the wider community, to say it in newspapers, to say it on news programs. Why is it always okay for those to bring these things about? And yet if some ordinary person does something, you get your collar felt. Now, with today, with what Rishi Sunak's actually said, I'm going to feel uncomfortable. No, well, I'm not worried, I'm not scared, but I'm going to feel uncomfortable going out in my wheelchair. Not just in case somebody attacks us, which they wouldn't do anyway, but the way they look at people in wheelchairs.
Okay, thanks. I think Freddie was first, then Dougie.
Yeah, I mean, taking on board what Steve just saying there. Yeah, listen, that type of approach to unemployed people with disabilities of one sort or another, there's nothing new about that. You go back, I can certainly recall, I think it was in the Thatcher years, where there was all this talk about, you know, people, this sort of sick milk culture, etc. And it's getting resurrected again now. My recollection is, though, that as I'm sure it's the sort of major Thatcher years, etc., that people were unemployed or had disabilities before the, you know, if they'd been on the sick for X length of time, that they were getting called up to the DSS by their own doctors at the DSS, if I can remember correctly. Because I remember the television programmes at the time when they were discussing it, that when people with a disability was getting invited in to review their situation, they were getting followed before they even got to the DSS place to see how well they were able to walk and such like. So this sort of attack upon people whom have a disability of one form or another, and even if you're unemployed without a disability, these attacks are nothing unusual about that at all. It just takes a slightly different tone on occasions. But the purpose of it is the same, is to help sort of reform or look at capitalism in such a way as, listen, you know, we're all shirkers. If it wasn't for the capitalist class, etc., we'd all, you know, we wouldn't be able to survive. It's nothing going to be further from the truth. And referring to what Andy was saying earlier on, Andy Davis was saying earlier on, I just watched a program the other night there. It was about a band called the Miami Show Band. It's on Netflix just now. And back in the 70s, when the troubles in Ireland were at their peak, and the British Army was involved in it, this particular band, the Miami Show Band, was stopped one night. They were based in Dublin, but were coming back from Belfast or something like that. My memory's not absolutely clear on it. They were coming back. They were going back home to Dublin, and just sort of crossed the border. Were getting near the border, and they were stopped for what looked like British soldiers. It turned out they weren't actually British soldiers. They were members of the Ulster Volunteer Force, who dressed up as British soldiers, but and the a bomb had been planted in this Miami Show Band's van, and whilst it got stopped, it exploded. Now, this Miami Show Band was made up of Catholics and Protestants, and they didn't, you know, it was no difference to them at all. They were playing in communities that were packed to the rafters, peoples of different religions and whatever it might be. But it ended up, one of these Miami Show Band, who was the bassist in this Miami Show Band, survived the bomb. And he's made it his life's sort of duty since then to find out, because during the course of this, when some of the people that were in the band were getting shot, he could hear this cultured English accent. And it transpires that this individual was a major or whatever in the British Army, who were in collusion with the UVF. So, I mean, where I'm trying to go with all of this is that we know what the problems with capitalism are. And some of this is just repeating itself time after time after time. That on the one hand, when migration from the Caribbean countries was in its heyday, that there was never any problem then with migrants coming here. They were encouraged to come here. You look on the television at times, some of these programs that are on about surgeons, it was just one on the other night there, but these surgeons and the operations that they undertake. Invariably, these surgeons that are doing the work, they're not from Britain. Invariably, they're from some other country with all these great skills, etc. I think at times we just make the case for socialism a bit too sort of complex, and we need to stick to, dare I say it, stick to the basics of it and propagate our case, the Socialist Party's case for socialism. And by all means, you know, we need to reply to critics, etc., and those that are supporters of capitalism, but we can deal with it in such a way that we don't need to subscribe to any sort of capitalist reforms. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We've got two more speakers, but the last two, I think we can, near 20 past. Okay, first Dougie and then Colin. Dougie.
Hi, yeah. I just saw something online about Rishi Sunak. He's talking about people, not people who are sick or whatever, or ill, talking about people who are unemployed or whatever for quite a long period of time. He's talking about stopping their benefits or whatever, you know, because the country can't afford it. That's what he's saying, right, you know, which is criminal, really. I mean, they can spend £37 billion on test, track and trace that didn't work and things, and they can spend money on PPE that didn't work, but they can't afford to give people money when they're unemployed or whatever. Anyway, just thought I'd mention that. Yeah. So, okay, that's all I wanted to say, right? Yeah.
I'm sure it's all about saving money, yeah. Okay, Colin, you're on, finally.
Thank you, Chair. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Yes, we can hear you quite clearly. Thanks.
I'm a fairly new member, about 3 weeks ago, and I'm pleased to become a member now. And having heard everything, or most of the things, I had a bit of a problem clocking in tonight. I'm pleased to listen to some of the comments that have been passed. But a generalisation of some of the things I've heard. First of all, I'm certainly not proud to say that our local I live in Richmond in North Yorkshire, and our MP is none other than the Prime Minister, who I have to question more and more with his multi-million pound family and his pool that he had built recently, costing £13,000 a year to heat, when we can ill afford the everyday power that we need to boil a kettle or have a bath or a shower or whatever it is. So that's one thing I have to criticise about Sunak, plus the fact some small number of years ago I had a Muslim friend here who unfortunately has died since, but we met up with Rishi Sunak, and he just basically, without explaining the full story, it will take time, the friend of ours was just turned upon by Sunak, and he didn't want to know him because he wasn't of the same ilk of Mr. Sunak. That's one thing. separate that, and I have to say this, I was bubbling at the seams to say this, because I, in my life, it's very important, and I think also that it fits in to the way the Socialist Party think in terms of racism or whatever it is. I am currently learning Russian. I have been for some years. It is a hobby of mine. I enjoy it. I don't really know why I want to do it, although I've always been interested in Russia from many years ago. But what I would say is that I have two Russian friends who I speak to on Skype. I have one Crimean friend that I speak to on Skype who is in effect Russian. I have one Israeli Jewish friend, formerly a Russian resident, who is my teacher of Russian. And I have one Ukrainian friend. Each of these people have their own thing to say, and in some sense, they don't seem to conflict. And what I appreciate, what I would like the world to know, is these people in my life, they are my friends, whoever they are, whatever they are, and they don't think anti-Britain or whatever. It is just in my life, my situation, it is a community of people that want to get together and speak and talk about the Russian language and other things. We do speak about all sorts of things, whether it's the weather, whether it's food or so on. That's all I have to say. But hopefully, it appears that I'm probably the last speaker, I hope to some degree that brings together some of the things that have been said tonight, that at the end of the day, without politics, without the greed for money, and without capitalism, we could all live together. I'll leave it at that. Thanks for the opportunity to say what I feel about that. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, and thank you. That's a good conclusion to this this meeting, which is going on without the speaker for an extra hour. Now, next week there is no Friday evening meeting, but if you want to listen to Socialists on Zoom, you can follow the party's conference, which is on the same at the same address.